nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
I want to start today with super interesting video from the former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who went on CNN and casually admitted to planning coups in the past. Now, this is fascinating, not in that it's a huge shock to any followers of American foreign policy over the years that the United States has been involved in organizing and planning coups. The interesting part is the just sort of casual and very nonchalant nature with which John Bolton says to Jake Tapper, listen, I've helped plan coups, and what Donald Trump did was not plan a coup. And the point that Bolton was trying to make was that Trump may have had delusions about staying in power, even though he didn't win. And he may have sort of casually said to Georgia officials or whoever, find me votes, send fake slates of electors or whatever. But that Trump was not organized enough. Trump was not smart enough, Trump was not scheming enough to really attempt a coup in any formal sense. And it's sort of a weird defense of Trump. And in so doing, he casually says, I've helped plan coups. This, when you plan a coup, it's much tougher than what Donald Trump was doing. So let's take a look at the first part of the conversation.
A lifetime occurrence.
I don't know that I agree with you, to be fair, with all due respect. One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, not here, but, you know, other places.
Of course.
It takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was
coups are really tough work, guys.
Just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt. But not to overthrow the Constitution, to buy more time to throw the matter back to the states to try and redo the issue. And if you don't believe that, you're going to overreact. And I think that's a real risk for the committee, which has done a lot of good work, mostly when the witnesses testify, not when the members are opining. It is invariably the case that when you go too far trying to prove your case, you undermine it. And I think you got to give credit to the intelligence of the American people to listen to the witnesses.
Okay, so the point that Bolton is making is what Trump did was so unorganized that it's really hard to call it a coup attempt. And Bolton, of course, is comparing what Trump did to the coup attempts he's been involved in, and they're much more meticulously planned, I guess Bolton is saying. Bolton is saying, when I know how to plan coups, and it's way more organized. And of course, that may be, but that doesn't change the intention of what Donald Trump was trying to do. Now, later in the interview, good for Jake Tapper, I guess, he goes back to this issue, but I do want to mention one thing, which is that Bolton, while he's saying the quiet parts out loud, obviously, Tapper was talking about attempting a coup. He said, you don't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup. And Bolton's saying to successfully execute the coup, you actually do need to be more brilliant, more organized, whatever. And it would have been important, I think, for Jake Tapper to say, well, hold on a second. Maybe you're right that for the coup to succeed, you need to be more intelligent or organized or whatever. But I'm talking about the attempt. And Trump attempted and failed, maybe due to incompetence, sort of talking past each other in that sense. And Tapper kind of lets him get away with it. It a little bit reminds me of this infinite monkey theorem. I don't know. This is just a silly thing. Well, maybe it's not silly, but it's the idea that if you put a bunch of monkeys in a room with a bunch of typewriters or maybe word processors or maybe personal computers or iPads or whatever with word processing software, if you put them in there long enough and let them tap away, eventually one of them will stumble across, you know, a Shakespearean play or something, and they will write it. And the idea being, okay, as incompetent as Donald Trump might have been, if you continue allowing incompetent people to feel around in the dark for ways to stay in power, eventually they might successfully do it. You might get a thousand failed coup attempts, and then eventually you get a successful one. Doesn't really make it any less dangerous if those are the intentions of someone in such a position of power. Jake Tapper goes back to it, and so let's look at that now. And John Bolton doesn't want to get into the specifics of the coups that he has planned.
To anathematize the rest of the Republican Party, and that's unacceptable.
I do want to ask a follow-up. When we were talking about what is capable, what you need to do to be able to plan a coup, and you cited your expertise having planned coups.
I'm not going to get into the specifics, but
it's so funny.
Successful coups?
Well, I wrote about Venezuela in the book, and it turned out not to be successful. Not that we had all that much to do with it, but I saw what it took for an opposition to try and overturn an illegally elected president, and they failed. The notion that Donald Trump was half as competent as the Venezuelan opposition is laughable.
Again, this is sort of, I mean, what he's saying is crazy. Obviously, the fact that he's planning coups is really hard work, Jake. Trust me. Take it from me. Again, if you try to bribe someone and the target rejects the bribe, you've still committed a crime, assuming it can be proven, of course. Just because you were incompetent at doing it, you might plan a murder and do it so incompetently that it doesn't succeed. It doesn't mean it isn't attempted murder. And this insistence on Trump's just not nearly as competent as I was, and even we weren't able to successfully do the coup, is a crazy defense.
But I think there's another.
I feel like this other stuff you're not telling me, though.
I'm sure there is. I think there's another point here that came out in the testimony that's not been stressed enough. Testimony.
All right. Okay. So now he's going on to other things. So stunning stuff. Casually admitting and saying, I'm not going to tell you about all the coups I've planned, but I'm much smarter than Trump, and even I didn't succeed in many of them. Incredible stuff, and just the reality of American foreign policy. There's no surprise. It is. The real shocker is, it is this casual for the neocons like Bolton that the U.S. plans and attempts and often fails at executing coups. It's just part of what they do. And it's like, we're better at Trump than Trump at it. And so Trump's attempt is really no big deal. Incredible stuff. We have a blockbuster new report out of Rolling Stone. Donald Trump's lawyers increasingly believe that Mark Meadows, his own former chief of staff, is going down legally. And it seems as though they may be getting closer and closer to abandoning Meadows. Now, there's a parallel story here to this, which is that yesterday I played for you video from the January 6th committee, wherein Liz Cheney says, we are now aware of Donald Trump personally calling a forthcoming witness, someone who has not yet testified, and trying to tamper with the witness, trying to influence or in some way affect their potentially forthcoming testimony. We don't know who that person is, but there's rampant speculation that it's Mark Meadows. And parallel to that, there is now this incredible story from Rolling Stone that Trump's lawyers think Meadows is going down. And the question now is how to minimize the sort of secondary damage, the shrapnel with which others may be hit if indeed Mark Meadows testifies and goes down. Rolling Stone writing, exclusive, Trump's lawyers think Mark Meadows is going down. The January 6th committee is probing the former chief of staff's finances, Rolling Stone has learned, adding to a long list of legal headaches. As she opened the January 6th committee on Tuesday, Liz Cheney ticked through a list of names of people Trump's legal team have attempted to pin the blame for the Capitol attack, naming the president's lawyers, MAGA-friendly lawmakers, and others. Mark Meadows didn't make the list yet, but Trump's inner circle increasingly views Meadows as a likely fall guy for the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Members of Trump's legal team are actively planning certain strategies around Meadows' downfall, including possible criminal charges. Trump has himself begun the process of distancing from some of his one-time senior aides' alleged actions around January 6th. This is the new part. Meadows' already bleak legal prospects could get even worse because Rolling Stone has learned that the January 6th committee has been quietly probing his financial dealings, and any new revelations would add to an already long list of unethical and potentially illegal actions he's accused of taking on behalf of Donald Trump. Quote, everyone is strategizing around the likelihood that Mark is in a lot of trouble, says a lawyer close to the former president. Everyone who knows what they're doing anyway. Rolling Stone spoke to 8 sources familiar with the matter. Everyone still in Trump's orbit or on his legal defense or in Republican circles in contact with Trump. Everybody speaking candidly because they were provided anonymity. So there's a few interesting components to this. First of all, it would not be unlike Donald Trump to run a multi-pronged strategy, publicly distance from the people that might be going down, and privately try to influence them in order for them to damage you less. And it's completely speculative, but there's the question, was the phone call that Trump made to try to tamper with a witness to Mark Meadows? The other part of this is that Meadows is actually, the financial questions around Meadows and the voting questions have been going on for a while. If I recall correctly, there's sort of 2 avenues to this. And it's sort of strange that everybody around Trump has these problems. Mark Meadows had one issue related to voter registration. I'm kind of giving you the 30,000 foot view, but apparently Meadows owns a trailer somewhere that he has never even been to and was registered to vote at that address, which is weird, and also registered to vote elsewhere. So that was one thing we talked about maybe 6, 8, 9 months ago, something like that. And then again, if I'm going from memory, I believe that on the financial side, there's something tax related to Mark Meadows, and it also may relate to what state do you formally live in or whatever the case may be. So if and how that connects directly to Trump is a question, but anything that puts him more on the radar of investigators is potentially bad for Donald Trump. So as far as the witnesses, there's a January 6th hearing sometime next week. I don't even know that it's been scheduled specifically yet. And we don't know who the witness is going to be, who the witnesses potentially are going to be. We've been told it's going to be absolutely stunning. Could it be Meadows? Could it be Steve Bannon? I don't know. But it could be maybe the most interesting day of the hearings altogether. Liz Cheney made clear this is a witness you have not yet seen. And that there's a long list of people that could fall into that category. But we will soon know. And if Meadows goes down, I mean, remember, the strategy from these people, Trump, et cetera, has been whenever anyone gets in trouble, minimize their role in the Trump campaign or the administration or in whatever. It's going to be impossible to minimize the role of the last and final chief of staff that Donald Trump had, who was personally doing the bidding of Trump in the lead up to the January 6th riots. I mean, they'll try, of course they'll try, but it's not going to be, I think even the average American, as we like to say, is going to see through that. Let me know your thoughts. Who do you expect to be the blockbuster witness coming up next week? You can find me on Twitter at @DPacman, and we'll be covering it, of course. I want to go back now to this viral story of a 10-year-old in Ohio impregnated after being raped and subsequently going to Indiana for an abortion because of Ohio's strict abortion laws. Now, we covered the story as it was reported a week or two ago. It was either early last week or late the previous week. And it's an incredibly disturbing story. Not surprisingly, many on the right said it was just a made-up story. And we're going to get to that in the second part of this segment. But that's not where I want to start. Where I want to start is the follow-up to the story, which is that an arrest has now been made of the alleged perpetrator. And this is part of what has now shifted the narrative from the American right on the story, which we will get to in due time. So here's the latest. The Columbus Dispatch reporting, arrest made in rape of Ohio girl that led to Indiana abortion, drawing international attention. Now, part of the reason why it drew international attention, national and international, was that this happened in the immediate aftermath of the Supreme Court announcing that Roe v. Wade is no more, that the fundamental right to an abortion in most cases in the country is no more. And people like South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, the Mississippi House Speaker, whose name I forget, and others were asked, what about cases where a kid is raped and impregnated? 12-year-old was the example that was often given. Would you feel comfortable forcing them to carry a child to term? And one of the reactions was, these are imaginary situations. These are mere hypotheticals. We don't deal in hypothetical. And very quickly, we had a real story. And that was much of why the story became viral in the way that it did. Well, the follow-up is the following. A Columbus man has been charged with impregnating a 10-year-old Ohio girl whose travel to Indiana to seek an abortion led to international attention following the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade and the activation of Ohio's abortion law. Gerson Fuentes, 27 years old, was arrested Tuesday after police say he confessed to raping the child on at least two occasions. He's since been charged with rape, a felony in the first degree, in Ohio. Columbus police were made aware of the girl's pregnancy through a referral by Franklin County Children's Services, made by her mother on June 22nd. On June 30, the girl underwent a medical abortion in Indianapolis. So first and foremost, the Indiana abortion part was a real part of the story. The right was desperate to say, that's fake. That's fake, and let's find whatever doctors are committing crimes here. It was a real part of the story. Hune, the detective, also testified that DNA from the clinic in Indianapolis is being tested against samples from Fuentes, as well as the child's siblings, to confirm contribution to the aborted fetus. As you can imagine, if that is confirmed, this will be an open and shut case. Now, one other interesting element here that I will discuss. Franklin County Municipal Court Judge Cynthia Ebner said the case did not warrant Fuentes, who is believed to be an undocumented immigrant, to be held without bond. Ebner said a high bond was necessary due to Fuentes being a possible flight risk and for the safety of the child. The bond was set at $2 million, and it is unclear whether the individual would be able to make that bond. So a few different things here. Number one, undocumented? Whoop! That's a perk-up word for Fox News. Fox News suddenly cares about the story again. When it was the rape of a 10-year-old with a pregnancy but unable to get an abortion, the story might be fake and it was not an interesting story. All of a sudden, now that the perpetrator, the believed perpetrator who has allegedly confessed and whose guilt may be proven by DNA very soon, is undocumented, now they care about the story, but they're spinning it. And we'll talk about that in the next segment. Now, of course, if there's a DNA match, this is going to be an open and shut case, and we will soon know that. Many of you emailing me saying, if there isn't a case that requires no bond, wouldn't it be this one? Because isn't the individual, if indeed he is an undocumented immigrant, potentially a flight risk to get out of the country? I think that that's absolutely true. And it's weird to me that that bond was granted. That being said, we don't know the financial situation of this individual. $2 million bond may be an impossibility. And even if you have to come up with 10% with a bail bondsman, $200,000 may be an impossibility. We just don't know. It may effectively be no bond. Don't know the answer to that. One other aspect to this. Very often in child rape cases, I get emails from people in the audience saying, I can't wait for this guy to end up in prison where, you know, they'll often say something like, where Bubba is going to give this guy an even stricter punishment than the time in prison. Talking, of course, about prison rape. I've said this before and I will say it again. No matter how vile the crime and no matter how strict the sentence, which this is a very serious alleged crime and the sentence should be very severe, the counting on the lack of security in our prisons so that people also are raped as part of an additional punishment, I think is absolutely disgusting. And I'm not denying that it happens, but when people say, you know, child molesters have it tough in prison, they're going to end up raped themselves, and I like that. We have a problem in American prisons that they are unable to keep inmates safe. It should, if you believe there should be stricter punishments for certain crimes, well, we can lobby for them. We can vote. We can find elected officials or whatever that will change the law to make the punishment stricter. But relishing off the record punishments that are the result of faulty prisons that aren't able to protect inmates, like, for example, prison rape of child molesters, it's very hard for me to say that, that's a good thing. The punishment should be that doled out by the justice system. And if this person is indeed the perpetrator, it should be a very severe punishment. But the relishing the prison rape stuff, hard for me to get behind that. Okay, so that's the update on the story. Let's now go to the right-wing reaction. Okay, so check this out. When we first heard about this absolutely horrible story of a 10-year-old girl raped and impregnated in Ohio, unable to get an abortion in Ohio because of the law, having to go to Indiana, the right-wingers started doing two things. One is they said, it's fake. It's a fake story. It's made up. None of it is true. None of this is happening. No one's going to Indiana. Absolutely not. And the second part of it was saying, is it a crime to go to Indiana for an abortion? We've got to find the doctor sending the girl to Indiana. We've got to find the doctor performing the abortion in Indiana. We need to charge these people, which is a crazy reaction. But let's focus on the first part, which was, it's made up. None of it is true. Well, it turns out that it is true. And suddenly, because the suspected rapist is believed to be an undocumented immigrant, they've quietly, these right-wingers who first said it was a fake story, they've started saying, well, yeah, she had to go to Indiana for an abortion thanks to that no good illegal that Joe Biden let into the country. Now, first of all, I've seen no evidence that this individual entered the country during the Biden administration. Maybe true, may not be, completely irrelevant to the story. But check out some of these examples. Governor Kristi Noem tweeted, a week ago, Dana Bash tried to trap me with a story about a 10-year-old girl who got an abortion. I pointed out nobody was asking about the pervert who raped that child. Now it looks like the story was fake to begin with, literal fake news from the liberal media. Well, it turns out that that story is absolutely and completely true. And Kristi Noem just called it fake for no reason. There was no reason to believe it was fake. There's a guy named Clay Travis, okay? He has a radio show and he's on some Fox show. He writes books and, you know, this type of thing. Okay, he tweeted multiple times that the story is straight up fake. Check these out. Everything Joe Biden said here appears to be a lie. Ohio law allows abortion for raped children. And more importantly, there is zero evidence that this actually happened. Tweeting again. Media reports of a 10-year-old girl being raped in Ohio and having to leave the state for an abortion appear to be completely made up. Tweeting again, Clay Travis rips apart IndyStar and the rest of the leftist media for allowing the story about a 10-year-old seeking an abortion to go viral. Well, the story was completely true. And now, with absolutely no egg on his face, no embarrassment whatsoever, which he should be feeling, Clay Travis updates the story and says, updating this viral story, which you said shouldn't have gone viral, a 27-year-old illegal immigrant in Ohio has been arrested for raping a 10-year-old girl. The girl could have gotten an abortion in Ohio under state law, but traveled to Indiana to have the abortion instead. So now the focus is, well, that's an undocumented immigrant. Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, who, by the way, does not exactly have a track record of reporting and taking seriously believed and alleged assault of minors, but that's a story for a different day. He deleted his tweet. He posted another lie. Anyone surprised about the story? And then that tweet has mysteriously disappeared. Sorry, that tweet has been deleted. They don't apologize. They instill fear and say, it's the left-wing media that's lying to you. They can't be trusted. They can't be believed. The entire thing is made up. Then it turns out they were lying, and then they just move on to the next thing. Now here, they have a little bit of an escape chute because the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, is believed to be an undocumented immigrant. If it weren't for that, they wouldn't even talk about the story. They now have a new angle, a new straw to grasp onto, which is this is an undocumented immigrant, and it's Joe Biden's fault, and look at the terrible thing that an undocumented immigrant did. Well, you were just saying that it never happened, and now the problem is a different one. It, completely predictable. And again, they will very casually say, the story's fake. even when there is no reason to believe that the story is fake. It was very real. It's a tragedy. It's a result, in part, of the abortion laws that these very same people want to be the laws in these states. That's where we are. And they just don't care. It's the Trumpian approach. You apologize. You just move on. You pretend you were never wrong, or you move on to something else, some shiny new object. They do it every time, and they're not going to stop. We'll have more on these stories on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Later on, we're going to look at some incredible video of a Republican congressman talking about post-birth abortion, which isn't a thing. I mean, it quite literally doesn't exist. We'll get to that later on in the show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Lily Geismer, who's an associate professor of history at Claremont McKenna College and also author of the book Left Behind, The Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. Really great having you on today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
So, I mean, I think an interesting place to start, or a logical place to start, would be most of my audience, I'm sure, would agree that at least the rhetoric and the promises of the Democratic Party relative to the Republican Party would seem more likely to reduce inequality and to sort of level the economic disparities that we see in the United States. And yet, to a great degree, it really hasn't happened. And we could talk about why that's the case. We could say, well, it's despite every good intention, it's simply Republican obstructionism, and sort of shift the blame elsewhere and take that approach. But you take a different approach in the book. Can you talk a little bit about the way you see what you call this failed attempt to deal with inequality?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the issues which you've identified, and this is not to say that I think the Republican Party is blameless in efforts to address inequality, but yeah. I think so often there's an effort to just sort of say putting blame solely on the Republican Party for its policies. And one of the things I really wanted to understand is that why inequity has increased so dramatically in the United States since the 1970s, but especially since the 1990s. And to understand the Democratic Party's efforts to address it and why those efforts didn't work. And what I came to largely is the fact that the Democratic Party, increasingly starting in the 1970s, started to try to use the private sector and the market as a tool to address inequality. And what I wanted to understand and what the book addresses is why those kinds of programs don't work, or why that approach actually led to shrinking the social welfare state and compounding inequality and really contributing to many of the kind of problems we are seeing today.
Yeah, so can you give us like one maybe example that might be an easily relatable one in terms of the idea of how to use the private sector, what was done, and why it did not work?
Well, there's a lot, and the book sort of tracks a bunch of them.
Yeah.
One of the really clear ones is the efforts to use programs like microenterprise or microfinance, which was this very popular tool in especially in the 1990s and really beginning in the 1980s. People like Bill Clinton had the idea. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with what microenterprise is, it's the idea of kind of giving small loans to poor people to start their own businesses. And so you start sort of micro entrepreneurs. It was first experimented with in the global south, especially in Bangladesh, by someone named Muhammad Yunus. And the Clintons in Arkansas in the 80s become really enamored with this program, and that you could kind of take what's a private sector tool of entrepreneurship and starting your own business. And that could actually be a replacement for traditional forms of welfare, and particularly forms of kind of cash assistance. So that's what Bill Clinton touts. And the idea is that, I mean, it removes the kind of social safety net and leaves poor people up to the kind of whims of the market. So the way it was sold is kind of like turn your hobby into a business. So you can, instead of needing sort of the support of government, you can kind of be your own entrepreneur. And that's one kind of program that was adopted. I can give a couple other examples too, but this idea of another one would be kind of turning to, in terms of housing, the program which comes to be known as Hope Six, which is a public-private mixed income program. So taking away like the kind of big public housing big public housing developments in Chicago, the most iconic ones are Cabrini Green or the Robert Taylor Homes, and instead turning to these more kind of the kind of townhouse style developments that can kind of earn a profit and will at the same time that will help people. And so that's another kind of approach that comes in, that is addressing this kind of critical problem of housing, but in a way that's kind of using the private sector. The book also looks at things like charter schools as a key example of this too, which is a kind of mechanism, using the mechanisms of the market. So charter schools, though, at least how the Democratic Party in the 90s promoted it, was not about making a profit, but was about using the techniques of the private sector to make public schools more efficient and accountable. And so all of those are kind of efforts to kind of address these, traditionally all of those welfare, housing, schools, the idea is that those are kind of critical components of what the public sector should be doing and what we rely on government to do. And instead, you're kind of taking mechanisms of the private sector to do that.
And it seems, at least in some cases, when these mechanisms or initiatives are created, it's also used as a justification to cut other programs. And it seems that it ends up being sort of zero sum in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And so one of the things I look at the book is there's a lot of this language of these are win-wins, because in a lot of the ideas is that it's, and another kind of critical program that I look at is like efforts to kind of treat poor communities like they're parts of the global South and to kind of bring corporate investment to them. So like the same way that globalization was working internationally, these sort of bring private sector investment. And that's like helps the community, brings jobs, brings Walgreens. But also helps companies like Walgreens gain a profit. And so it's a win-win, but it's actually in many ways a zero sum in the fact that like who benefits in that mechanism is the companies more than the kind of places or people who live there.
When I recently interviewed Gary Stevenson, who's an inequality economist, he said that of everything he's looked at and has studied extensively, that at the end of the day, the most effective way to reduce inequality is through government taxation. Basically, a government deciding, here's how we're going to use taxation. We're going to, and you know, the specific policies are, of course, to be discussed. But that's really the way to do it. Is your experience that is the most effective?
Yeah, I think it's taxation coupled with intense government spending, and so spending by the federal government and by state governments into providing for people. So the common, and that's often achieved through taxation of largely of the wealthy, and that's really important. I mean, I think because one of the ways that this kind of approach, and so it's really kind of comes into fruition in the 90s during the Clinton administration, is this idea of, and the Clinton administration did enact some modest taxes on the wealthy, but not to the kind of full extent. But their idea was really that you give corporations and wealthy people the sort of opportunities to help rather than actually making them make any kind of real sacrifice. And that's kind of what a taxation approach would do, that it would reduce inequality in those terms and make more funding of money available to help people in need and sort of rebuild or sort of have a vibrant social safety net.
So, I mean, I think this next question, it's sort of like an economics question, but I think it's also a history question. And of course, you can answer it in whichever way you think is appropriate. When I hear sometimes some on the left who they're not taken super seriously in most cases, but they talk about a 73% marginal tax rate or a 78 on really, really high incomes. I understand the math of it. And I understand the studies about government revenue is maximized when you have that top tax rate at about 73%. And I get it, but it also seems completely politically infeasible right now. And also there's this major issue of no matter what the rates are, there's lots of ways to get around paying anything at all and deductions and loopholes and the way businesses and other things are used. So from a historical perspective, in terms of what's viable and what's acceptable to populations, where do you think the Democratic Party should be on tax policy?
Well, I think there is, I mean, I think what has been largely popular has been this idea of, and I don't know the exact, I can't do the exact numbers. I'm terrible at math, so I don't want to give you or anyone else the wrong impression. But I think that one of the things that comes up with that is that actually I do think that message of that that corporations and wealthy people should be held responsible and should not be kind of and that goes with both sort of what they're paying, but also that those loopholes need to be closed. And I think that actually has been a really popular message, both, and you saw it in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's campaigns. And I think that that actually, that has bipartisan appeal to some degree too. So that is a popular message. I think when you get into the numbers, probably that it's more complicated. I think one of the issues that goes to this too is that you'd actually need with that corporate closing things like the corporate loopholes and various different other things, is that actually goes to regulation. And that's another kind of critical piece. And so I think one of the things I looked at in the book is the ways in which so much of, and this goes to kind of thinking about what Republicans and Democrats have done, that especially during the Clinton era, there was so much deregulation of the financial and tech sectors. And that's really contributed to some of these kinds of inequalities too. So it's both in terms of regulation in various different capacities that actually do force corporations to pay more of their share. That is a way of kind of addressing some of these kind of major structural inequities that exist.
It also seems that sometimes it's not, I don't want to say it's difficult, like people don't have the cognitive capacity, but it's just people are busy and they have lives. And so the idea of, well, let's raise taxes on the rich. Okay, right. But usually that means income taxes, and the very rich often don't pay income tax because they're earning money through other means. Okay, well, then let's raise capital gains rates. It's like, okay, well, you can do that, but then instead of selling stock, you can pledge the stock as collateral for a loan, which is another mechanism that's used. And it's not that people can't understand these things, but it's most people aren't, you know, buried in these things day to day because they're working and so on and so forth. It seems that that also is sort of a difficulty, even when a solution is proposed that isn't really a solution, like just raising income tax rates. So there's a communication aspect to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a really important point. These are really complicated things, and the kind of mechanisms that are used are hard to understand, don't sort of distill down to a soundbite. And so your eyes can glaze over. It just doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't seem like it's affecting day-to-day life in various different ways, I think, for the average person. And I think the other kind of piece of that too, is the ways in which, so I think this goes to the way we think about inequality. And this also goes back to, like, sort of in, my book, I looked primarily at the kind of this period of the 90s, when there is kind of large economic growth. Like, we look back in the 90s with some nostalgia of this period of, like, and so that's one of the things that happened. I mean, is that you have overall economic growth, but inequality increasing. And I think the other kind of key piece of that is taking away these components of the social safety net and sort of turning to the private sector and the market to solve those problems. Creates a system of profound kind of vulnerability and predation by corporations. So that's sort of some of the kind of the products of some of these issues too, coupled with huge amounts of personal private wealth being amassed over the 90s, but in these with other kinds of mechanisms such to use them. And I will go back to saying I don't think this is just all of this falls, you know, solely on the Democratic Party. I think the Republican Party and particularly the George W. Bush administration played a really important role in kind of widening a lot of these kinds of policies. But I do think it's really important to understand where the Democrats have been complicit in many ways and pushed them in different avenues.
Yeah, Bill Clinton, you've mentioned Bill Clinton a couple of times, and Bill Clinton will often get arguably deserved amount of blame for this, but also, I mean, 1994 and Newt Gingrich coming into the House of Representatives and that huge push for deregulation and so on and so forth. And then George W. Bush as well, precipitating the 2008 recession. There seems to be a lot of blame to go around here.
I think totally. And so that's one of the things is that sort of in trying to kind of parse some of that out and to sort of understand. And the other thing that I really tried to do in my book, which I think is also really important, are twofold. One is understanding what the Democrats and particularly people like Bill Clinton and the other kind of new Democrats of the Democratic Leadership Council, what they believed and what they did, and also that those are not sort of indistinguishable from the Republican Party, that there are actually distinctions in the kinds of policies and the reasons for why Democrats versus Republicans pursue particular ideas, and that there was a genuine belief that stimulating the private sector and stimulating certain forms of new economic growth and tech, finance, and trade would be a way to address, create forms of social equality. But that's not what ended up happening. And so that's really what I've like tried to understand through my work.
Last thing I want to ask about, often when I ask folks, what is the model of a country that has sort of done this correctly? Usually you hear countries in Northern Europe or Denmark, Sweden, Norway, et cetera, and everybody just kind of shrugs their shoulders and you know, stops talking about it. Are those actually the models? Are there models? Are there successful examples to look at of reducing inequality?
I've been watching so much Borgen, and I feel like I want.
That's a great show. Yeah, I'm watching this new season. It's great.
It's great. I strongly recommended it, but imagine it's like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
I think that those are always the places, but I think the really important thing about that, I mean, when I look at those places, is they're really homogenous.
Yep.
And traditionally, and so where social, we sort of look to these European countries as kind of the kind of mecca, but they've had huge issues and tensions over immigration and sort of who is part of their social welfare. And I think that's actually another sort of critical piece in the United States is the ways in which inequality sort of becomes kind of immersed with questions of race and how that operates, of sort of who is worthy of certain kinds of assistance. And so I do think that many Western European countries are also experiencing the same kinds of questions today. But I do think the ways in which the commitments to social spending and to having a kind of robust social safety net and social wealth is critical. I know, and because I know you've mentioned the viewers, but you are to your that you just had a baby, and when you look at the kind of differences of what parental and child care are in many Western European countries, it's like, it's astounding to the difference of the United States. So on those levels, I do think that does contribute to forms of inequity, of sort of fundamental inequity in the United States. So I do think that there is a place, and Denmark is a country of 6 million people, so we shouldn't all move there, but
right.
I do have these.
It's like a state in the US basically.
Yeah, exactly.
The book is Left Behind, The Democrats' Failed Attempt to Solve Inequality. We've been speaking with the book's author, professor of history at Claremont McKenna College, Lily Geismer. Really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
So there's been some super interesting testimony this week about reproductive rights and abortion and care for pregnant women in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade being overturned by the Supreme Court. And the Republicans on this congressional panel have been just embarrassing themselves day after day after day. And today I want to look specifically at a series of questions from Republican Congressman Ralph Norman, who represents South Carolina's 5th District. He completely humiliated himself with these questions about post-birth abortion after birth, which quite literally just doesn't exist. It's not a thing. When a baby dies after birth, it's not an abortion. We're talking about something completely different. And Renita Shannon, who's a Democratic state rep from Georgia, and others did the best they could to keep up with these absurd questions and see if you can find the full list. Like, some of them will be obvious, but see if you can really find the full list of fallacious claims by this guy.
You agree with infanticide?
Well, I think.
Okay, so first of all, do you agree with infanticide? Already, we're talking. What are you talking about? Infanticide? Are we talking about abortion here, or are we talking about murder when kids are out in the world?
Using inflammatory language to basically describe a situation that does not happen. We don't have infanticide happening. Doctors would not do that, and neither would folks who have carried pregnancy.
Okay, would a healthy child? Do you agree if a healthy child is born, that is that woman's right to decide if it lives or dies?
What I think is, based on your question, you have a very low opinion of pregnant people. Because if you think anybody would carry...
Answer the question.
Excuse me.
Answer the question.
I'm answering it.
No, you're not.
You want to answer
it,
or you want to keep talking over witnesses? What I'm telling you is nobody would carry a pregnancy and then decide on a Monday because they are bored that they want to have an abortion. That's ridiculous. And it's inflammatory, what you're saying. You're talking about families who are in tough situations where folks have been excited about carrying a pregnancy. Most of the abortions that happen later in pregnancy are really tragedies where it's really a disappointment for everyone involved.
But you agree with, I take it with all those words, you do agree with basically murdering a child after they're born. Miss Gray.
Now, this is supposed to be about abortion. This isn't about murdering children after they're born. It's quite literally a completely different question.
Could you answer that? Would you just yes or no?
I have to say, Congressman, how you just characterize the representative statement is extremely inflammatory and the type of thing that it's dangerous.
And what
you guys
saying-
have been talking today about the threats against crisis pregnancy centers, which I assume are serious and
yeah. By the way, crisis pregnancy centers are places that convince women not to get abortions.
Are terrible. The threats that people who work on abortion access take every single day.
I'm assuming that you're for infanticide. I would also say that her language of health,
Madam Chair,
this is generally absurd. Now, this guy is an embarrassment to himself and to his state and to his constituents. There's no doubt about it. Nobody supports abortion after birth because there is no such thing. Now, all of the questions this guy's asking are obviously bad faith questions. The questions are being asked in order not to be answered. And I do think that the witnesses could have been better prepared for how to answer them. Like, I get that they're bad faith questions. They want you not to answer by making it a bad faith question so that then you look bad. I believe the best approach is answer it and then explain that the question's absurd. And it's a frustrating thing all around to watch because this guy is such an embarrassment. I mean, it's hard to imagine a worst faith line of questioning on what is a very serious issue. But he should have been dunked on for equating abortion with murder. Nobody's really even, they're talking past each other in a certain sense. It's not an abortion because birth happened. It's a mind-numbingly stupid question. But they should be able to say, no, we're not for that. And that has nothing to do with decisions, very difficult decisions that relatively few families have to make in the third trimester. They are two completely different things. They continue to stretch this cartoonification of abortion into, well, is it okay to kill a child 1 month after they're born? What about 6 months? Well, what about just deciding at 2 years old? You're not liking this parenthood thing. So the question can be answered. Congressman, of course I'm not for infanticide. And what we're talking about here are, there's not a pediatrician involved. There's an OBGYN, because what we're talking about here is a pregnancy. It's still a pregnancy at 7 months, 8 months, et cetera. And it's exceedingly rare. Nobody goes in a week before their due date and says, you know what? I want to get an abortion. Every OBGYN who has testified over the last 2 weeks on that says it never happens and we wouldn't do it. Now, could you find someone that would say, sure, I'll do it? Probably you could find someone. Doesn't mean it's even something that's happening. But the questions are designed for you to feel like you can't answer them so that you don't, so that Norman can go and say, since you're not answering, I must assume you're okay with infanticide. The entire thing is mind-numbingly stupid. They could have been better prepared. He's still embarrassing. He still should be embarrassed, but they could have been better prepared. Okay, dozens of you have asked me to address this issue, and I'm ready to address it today. I've been waiting for the story to develop a little bit. Some of you might remember this guy named Jesse Lee Peterson. Jesse Lee Peterson is sort of a prominent black conservative. He's a Christian pastor. He has a men's counseling center in Los Angeles, which I've been to when I was on Jesse's program a couple of years ago. His studio and his radio show all go out of the same building. I believe it's called The Bond in Los Angeles. And it turns out, it appears that the very openly homophobic, anti-gay Christian pastor Jesse Lee Peterson is gay. And I'm going to talk about my experience with him, which included him being pretty handsy with me, to be perfectly honest. I wasn't sexually harassed. I didn't feel intimidated or anything. But at the time, I just wrote it off to this guy's just a character. You know, he's just handsy. But I'm going to get back to that. Okay? So here's the story. The Daily Beast now reporting. Allegations of Manosphere pastor's gay past royal macho men. Jesse Lee Peterson has emerged as one of the right's most vocal anti-gay figures, but his one-time friends now allege that the pastor has had many same-sex relationships. I'm not going to give you every claim, but there are so many stories now of people saying, I was involved in sexual, like men saying I was involved in sexual activity with Jesse Lee Peterson. He comes on to people aggressively in many cases, etc. Two of Peterson's former male associates came out in June with on the record interviews saying they engaged in sexual activities with him. Other men say he propositioned them. These allegations about the pastor, who is publicly staunchly heterosexual, have ripped like an earthquake through the manosphere, prompting some Peterson allies to abandon him and prompting one manosphere conference to ban him altogether. The Daily Beast was not able to substantiate the allegations. Peterson's ministry, a brotherhood organization known as Bond, did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Okay, so what's my view on this? I don't care about his sexuality, per se. I really could not care less. At this point, I just don't care about people's sexual orientation. It's boring to me. I just don't care. Now, Jesse Lee Peterson is definitely an odd guy. He is seemingly obsessed with talking, despite being a black man, talking about how great white people are and how terrible black people are. And he's also obsessed with talking about how terrible and sinful and horrible it is to be gay. And he supposedly counsels young men out of being gay, or at least that's what he claims to do. And it seems as though he is also gay himself. Okay. What I can tell you is that the vibe at his counseling office was really, really weird. So let me tell you what I personally observed. Was he handsy at his office? He was. He kept, you know, when we took pictures, he was sort of like weirdly hugging me, arm around me in a way that's like, it's not, it doesn't raise any red flag. I didn't think he was coming on to me. I didn't feel intimidated or whatever. There were people around. But it was just like, it was the first time I was meeting him and he was a little bit handsy and I didn't really think anything of it. Now in this context, maybe that was something sort of different. He was kind of like whispering into my ear, like not sweet nothings. It was actually about Trump. He was like, and I've said this before, like, you're going to vote for Trump, aren't you, David? You're going to vote for Trump. And I quite literally thought absolutely nothing of it, like nothing at all, like what people are describing. The atmosphere at his office with young men kind of hanging around, the fact that he counsels young men with Christian counseling, I did find it all weird, but not because I thought it was a way for him to proposition dudes, because it just seemed like this is the last guy who should be counseling young men. And of course, he takes advantage of this entire thing, where as many of you know, to say one is a therapist, you actually need a license. You either need to be a psychologist or a licensed social worker, licensed independent social worker, psychiatrist, licensed mental health counselor. He was none of these things. The term counselor or coach can be used by anybody. And he claimed to be a counselor. And of course, he's just a pastor. He doesn't actually have any therapy credentials. And that was the biggest red flag. And there were all these young men hanging around and it was odd. So is it a shock? I mean, not really, in the sense that we've seen now dozens of the most openly and notably homophobic Christian figures actually be gay themselves. In that sense, it's not really a shock. It's only sort of surprising because this is the only one that I personally know and who's, you know, I was with him at his office and all of these different things. So that's really all I have to say about it. It's not, I mean, you know, it's not, when people started emailing me saying, David, it turns out Jesse Lee Peterson is gay. Okay. I mean, that's, my concern is more about what are the lives that he has potentially ruined. Now, one other thing, there was this interesting moment. Jesse Lee Peterson is all about alpha, the alpha male. And he says, if you're on the left, you're beta. He's called me a beta male. And we had an interview where I asked him, are you in a relationship? Are you sexually active or whatever? And he said that he's off sex, and he's off sex because out of wedlock, I think was the term he used, you know, it's inappropriate or whatever, but he seemed visibly uncomfortable with the line of questioning. And again, is it all related to this entire hidden homosexuality thing that's going on? Maybe, I don't know, you know, in retrospect, hindsight starts to become clearer and clearer, but I don't really know that any one of these things is sort of like a big, oh, it should have been obvious that he was one of these homophobic gay guys. I can't. I really can't say that. I can only speak to my personal experience, and that's what it is. Very. I mean, it's a sad story. It's not sad that he's gay. It's sad that he's gay and homophobic. That's always sad when people can't just be who they are. And also that I have a very strange feeling about the entire counseling of young men. Quite frankly, we're talking about boys in many cases that he was doing. And who knows what else we may learn about this in the future. That's about it. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a very disturbing COVID conspiracy theorist who called in. Listen to this.
Yo, Pax, what up, man? Total Control 871. Yo, what's up with the surge? From what I understand, the COVID is surging again. But why does it always surge in the communist-controlled states? The deep blue states where it surges. Surge! Surging! Oh, my God, it surges. What can I say? I'm sorry. Sorry about that. You know, the surge, it catches one unawares. And what can I say? You know, guys like me over 50, shot free and COVID free. For some strange reason, I never get sick.
So this is what we call extrapolating inaccurately from an anecdote. There are tens of millions of people who have not had COVID, and some of them are unvaccinated. And the fact that this caller didn't get COVID and isn't vaccinated tells us actually nothing about the pandemic.
That's so weird. It's almost like the pandemic doesn't exist.
and so that's what we call extrapolating too far. He didn't get sick, so it must all be imaginary.
Hey, we know that's crazy talk. You know, that's a conspiracy. Surge! 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 Oh, oh, surge! Oh, oh, woo! Sorry, Dave. That was a real surge. That was a real strong surge. Oh, my God. That was, woo! I think I almost went blind with that one. Oh, my God. I just surged all over myself.
All right. So as you can see, these are not exactly the types of folks that you can really speak rationally with. That guy actually called into the show once about a year and a half ago, and his talking points were pretty similar. It's tough to get everybody on the same page about basic facts when you've got people who believe stuff like that. That's where we can leave it. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Won't even tell you what's on it. You'll just have to tune in to see. Get instant access to the bonus show by signing up at joinpacman.com. And you can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to get a
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Deposed from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You're seeing galaxies that are shining around other galaxies whose light has been bent. And you're seeing just a small little portion of the universe.
This week, NASA released the first images from its new flagship James Webb Space Telescope, revealing an unprecedented view of the cosmos.
So much of this is going to be just a treasure trove for astronomers when they're able to analyze the details of this picture. So I'm really excited about that, what we're going to learn from it.
Today, Science Friday of sorts, we'll look at the newest images from space with theoretical astrophysicist Katie Mack, the Stephen Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada. And we'll look at the controversy over naming the telescope after James Webb. He led NASA during the Apollo moon landings in the 60s, also played a key role in purging LGBTQ plus people from NASA, and before that, the State Department in what was known as the Lavender Scare.
There's no doubt that James Webb was a talented NASA administrator who advocated for the inclusion of science programs. But would Webb himself have wanted this telescope to be named after him when so many people were objecting?
We'll speak with astronomer Lucianne Walkowitz with the Just Space Alliance, which just released the documentary Behind the Name, James Webb Space Telescope, that will feature today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden has met with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Earlier today, Biden traveled from Israel to the Palestinian Authority's presidential compound in Bethlehem. Along the way, his motorcade passed billboards and banners protesting U.S. support for Israel's occupation, as well as the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot dead by Israel's military last May next to the Jenin refugee camp. In a joint news conference with President Abbas, Biden claimed the U.S. continues to support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He also defended the U.S. response to the killing of Abu Akleh.
She was an American citizen, and a proud Palestinian. I hope that her legacy will inspire more young people to carry on her work of reporting the truth and telling stories that are too often overlooked. The United States will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting of her death and will continue to stand up for media freedom everywhere in the world.
Biden's remarks came after he rejected a request by Shireen Abu Akleh's family to meet with him during his visit to Israel. Abu Akleh's niece, Lina Abu Akleh, wrote, quote, "We would like Biden to do in Shireen's case what his and previous U.S. administrations have failed to do when other American citizens were killed by Israel. Hold the killers accountable," she said. Meanwhile, Biden's traveling today from Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport on a direct flight to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he'll meet senior Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Press freedom groups are demanding Biden confront the prince over the killing and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. In 2018, the CIA concluded bin Salman personally ordered his assassination. The House of Representatives has approved $839 billion in new military spending for the coming fiscal year. The National Defense Authorization Act passed on a vote of 329 to 101 with the support of 180 Democrats. Lawmakers overwhelmingly voted down an amendment put forward by progressives that would have shaved $100 billion from the Pentagon budget. They also defeat an amendment to reverse an additional $37 billion piled on to President Biden's record budget request. Meanwhile, all 208 House Republicans voted against an amendment